This is Jim Fester, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Today we have an especially interesting topic of discussion. My guest, Russell Gerst, is a member of Scholars for 9/11 Truth with a background in mathematics, and he is a certified public accountant. He was drawn into the movement by having watched the video In Plain Sight, which became perhaps controversial for reasons that might actually not be good reasons for controversy, but in any case, it was an excellent video in very many respects. He was also struck by the freefall speed of the Twin Towers destruction and the inability of the government to explain the speed with which the buildings were destroyed. Because of his background in mathematics, it was easy for him to understand the impossibility of what was going on, a point that would be formalized by Judy Wood's billiard ball model, demonstrating that the speed with which all these things were going on, according to the government's account, if you assumed a pancake collapse, was simply impossible. He has taken a special interest in divisions within scholars, we're going to be talking about that. Russell, it's a great pleasure to welcome you to the Dynamic Duo.
Hello, Jim. How are you?
Just terrific. A real pleasure to have you on. Now, I take it that around August of 2006, you became acquainted with or familiar that some data was not being shared by various researchers within the scholars group, especially a clique that was surrounding Stephen Jones. Just for background of some listeners, when I founded Scholars in December of 2005, I invited Stephen Jones, a physicist at Brigham Young University, to be my co-chair. But by the end of 2006, in November, when I had become very convinced that his approach was not going to pan out, his emphasis on conventional explosives and cutter charges wouldn't be adequate. Judy Wood had elaborated, together with Morgan Reynolds, had elaborated a huge variety of considerations related to the destruction of the World Trade Center, not just the towers, but the World Trade Center as a totality, that convinced me that Steve's approach wasn't likely to pan out. In fact, he was saying then the same things he had been saying back in December. He was saying in November. In fact, to this day, he seems to me to be saying exactly the same things he was saying then. No new research, no new studies, no new hypotheses, and it was what is classically known in the philosophy of science as a degenerating research program. And at that point, I began to emphasize the necessity of considering alternative approaches that require, you know, massive sources of energy that go beyond what conventional sources like dynamite or RDX, much less thermite or thermate, can provide, including the possibility of some kind of high-tech weapons, including perhaps lasers or masers or plasmoids or antimatter. Where Judy has continued her research on her site at drjudywood.com, as most of the listeners to this program are well aware. In fact, most recently I had her on to discuss the importing of massive quantities of dirt and the fact that there appears to be a lot of indications that molten metal was almost certainly not present at that time, but that there was the residue, the fumes from the molecular dissociation from some of these high-tech weapons. And when I started to broaden the range to consider non-conventional alternative explanations, a split emerged in scholars. A group went with Steve, sought to undermine the Scholars for 9/11 Truth, and created an alternative group called which I consider to be ironically called Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice. And I take it, Russ, it was somewhere in this point of time that you became aware that there was information out there or whatever that wasn't being shared.
Well, it was kind of brought to my attention by a couple of the researchers who were actually involved in the scientific analysis. My background not being scientific, I wasn't so much involved in that, which meant, unfortunately, like many of the 9/11 truth folks out there, we were kind of accepting on blind faith that research information and data was being shared. And it was kind of brought to my attention that that wasn't occurring, and it was kind of in a one-way direction. Certain researchers were sharing all of their information, but that clique surrounding Jones necessarily wasn't. And at that point, I felt like I needed to take a step back. It's like I needed to make more observations of what I was seeing the various people do, what they were saying, and kind of look back at my own recollections of what had happened over the course of the last year since, you know, I'd started really following the subject and then joining the scholars group. And I guess one of the defining thoughts that I had as I was kind of looking back at everything was a conference that was held in Chicago in early June 2006.
Yeah.
And I recalled the keynote speech that was given by Dr. Jones late that evening. I think it was the Friday night that the conference started. And the entire speech that he gave was essentially identical to one he had given earlier in, I think, February. And along with, you know, a lot of fluff and stuff related to constitutional issues, and it's like, what about the science? And I think there was only one, maybe two slides in the presentation that involved anything new that hadn't already been discussed all the way back in February. And in looking back at that, it's like, where is the research leading us? Where is more data? And the more I started looking at the other researchers, including Dr. Wood, there was a lot more evidence being presented in the form of pictures, in videos of the site during those periods of time. And it seemed odd to me that, you know, everything related to Dr. Jones' information was all just, you know, a few numbers here, a few numbers there. But never looking directly at a lot of the individual pictures which we're now seeing and comparing the data with the theory that's being, you know, put forward. So I started having a lot of issues related to that.
And this was already in Chicago in early June.
Well, it was in August when I was kind of hit by this, that the data wasn't being shared. And then it was a matter of kind of sifting back through all of my experiences and all of the, you know, the evaluations that I had done and all the reading I had done through the scholars group and all the various data that was available through them. And one of those key issues was kind of looking back at my experience at that particular, you know, forum.
Yeah.
And the other thing I did when I was in Chicago, I actually had a chance to visit with Dr. Jones just briefly in one of the sessions, the breakout sessions. And I thanked him for his presentation. I said I did catch on to the couple of slides there toward the end that, you know, talked about a little bit new. And I think it related to findings of the supposed components in the dust related to thermite. And I said, I noticed that those two things were in there. He's like, yeah, I wanted everybody to kind of see that. And, you know, at the time, I didn't give it a second thought, but the more I look back on it, it's like, is he just, you know, slipping a little bit here and a little bit there? And then when I was told that the data wasn't being shared, it's like, you know, is he sharing that information?
Stand by, Russ. We'll be right back with my special guest, Russ Gerst. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest, Russ Gerst, has a background in mathematics. He's a certified public accountant. He's a longtime student of 9/11. And he's giving us a kind of excursion, autobiographical in many ways, of the way in which he has been able to sort out what's been going on, or shall we say, his take on what's taking place in the 9/11 movement. Russ, I really appreciate this. I think it's good to have somebody who's used to dealing in a very precise way with issues like this, because it helps the rest of us to get a fix on what's been taking place. Please do tell us more about, you were saying around August of 2006, it was becoming apparent to you that information was not being shared by a particular group in a clique surrounding Stephen Jones.
Yeah, and what I kind of did was take a couple months where I just kind of backed away from being directly involved and just more so observed what was going on in the landscape. I know there was a big rift that occurred, you know, that split the group up between Dr. Jones and yourself in late 2006, and I kind of observed all the back and forth that was going on there, some of the attacking that was going on. And as we moved into early 2007, another topic came up through some of the other researchers in the group that was talking about the cold fusion debate, which had happened, you know, 15 years before, back in the late 80s, early 90s. And I became intrigued when I saw a video that was called Heavy Watergate that was out on Google. I mean, anybody can go out and look at it for themselves. And it was very professionally done. I mean, there were the narrator of the entire video is someone that people have seen on the big screen and as well as on television. So it wasn't like, you know, somebody made this in their own home studio and just made up a bunch of different information that couldn't be tracked down. One of the key scenes within that talks about how Stephen Jones, you know, professor of physics at Brigham Young University, had all but basically helped shut down the research into cold fusion. And it intrigued me to start researching on my own then the documentation related to that topic and see how it maybe relates to what Dr. Jones and his group was doing related to 9/11.
Just to throw in a comment here for those who may not appreciate this, if cold fusion were possible, if it were possible to produce a great deal more energy than is required to initiate the process that produces it, we might here have a solution to the world's energy crisis that might free us from dependency on fossil fuels, gasoline and oil in particular, so that this is a huge issue that could actually lead to a form of liberation of humanity if it were to pan out. Please continue.
Yes. And what I found was a number of books, particularly one by Eugene F. Maloff, called Fire from Ice, Searching for the Truth Behind Cold Fusion. And this book, to give a little perspective, was written back in 1991. So it was all well before anything related to 9/11. I mean, all the perspective was based on that one particular topic. And there are just numerous, time after time, various key notes in the book related to Dr. Jones' involvement in that whole situation and how cold fusion became, you know, a household name that everybody just, you know, said was the most crazy, ridiculous thing ever heard. And it was the involvement of several different scientists as well as the United States government that kind of threw that into the limelight as far as that cold fusion was crazy, it was pathological science, and all kinds of ad hominem attacks were being made against Drs. Pons and Fleischmann, who initially came out with their theory in 1989.
Just to be clear on the title of the book, Russ, it's Eugene Maloff's book, Fire from Ice, Searching for the Truth Behind the Cold Fusion Furor, 1991.
Yep, and it can be found on Amazon.com. And a host of other sites that sell books. So,
well, I'm extremely interested in what you take to be the similarities or parallels. Of course, when you talk about ad hominems and so forth, and I mean, they'll talk about the dismissal of space beings and so forth. You know, this all seems to me to be very irresponsible and very bad science. In fact, it's the antithesis of science to try to lampoon or ridicule another scientist's perspective or hypothesis. So this sounds like it might be a fascinating source of insights.
Well, and one of the key issues related to the bad mouthing of the science was, you know, in the cold fusion saga, most of the physics society or the American Physics Society, the people that were bad mouthing it the most were the least willing to look at the evidence that was being presented. And it tends to go hand in hand with what we're seeing with Dr. Wood's analysis as well as others, that, you know, we're going to badmouth it, we're going to cause space beams and all this crazy stuff, but we're not going to look at specifically what she's putting forward. And if you look at the details of the analyses, what Dr. Woods is putting forward is, we don't know exactly what it is, but it would appear that some form of directed energy must have been used to create the phenomena that we're seeing. And it's very similar to what was expressed by Jones during the cold fusion theory. I mean, he put forward that, you know, there was no heat generated, even though the heat generated was really the most important part of the cold fusion theories that were being put forward by Pons and Fleischmann, that there was no radiation. And, of course, all the physicists were saying you have to have radiation or it couldn't be fusion. So it was immediately being badmouthed and poor boyed by the physics community, and, you know, Dr. Jones was right in the middle of that.
Well, that's pretty fascinating, because we're getting a lot of that kind of lampooning and ridiculing going on right now. I mean, even if you go to 9/11 Blogger today, there's a new post from the spokesperson for Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice, Victoria Ashley, who is attacking several persons who are on the list of patriots for 9/11 Truth, and it includes several of the techniques that you're discussing. We'll be right back with my special guest, Russ Gerst. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Today, my special guest, Russ Gerst, has a background in mathematics. He's a certified public accountant, and he's been observing the development of the 9/11 truth movement recently, especially the division within scholars. Russ, when I was out in Chandler, Arizona, the question arose whether, during a press conference, whether the 9/11 movement was infiltrated. And I responded, of course. I mean, it would be ridiculous to imagine that the government would pull off a major operation like this and not then have plans to control it. And I pointed out how in the 40s and the 50s, there were communist cell party meetings where every person present was an informant for the FBI. And the problem, of course, is to sort out who is and who isn't trying to control the movement and steer it one way or another. I find this case I'm just mentioning involving this Victoria Ashley, who is a spokesperson for Scholars for Truth and Justice, and that name really grates on me, in part because they had sponsored this citizen's grand jury out in San Diego where the jurors never even had the opportunity to deliberate, and yet they went ahead and offered press release that was distributed to 2,000 different sites, making all kinds of claims based upon findings that the jury never did present, including a list of some 16 persons who were supposed to be subject to some kind of indictment or consideration for indictment. It was really, in my opinion, given the repudiation by the members of the jury, an outrageous event. And it featured Don Paul and Jim Hoffman and others who were associated with this group for truth and justice. And now Victoria Ashley is repeating her, doing a reprise of an event she does and putting posts up on the Truth and Justice website where, for example, in announcing that a group from Truth and Justice, really a couple of members of survivors' families, had constructed a request for a correction under the Data Quality Act, which had been pioneered by Jerry Liepart, a member of Scholars, and where the initial submissions were from Ed Haas and from Morgan Reynolds and from Judy Wood. And in a gratuitous aside, extolling the virtues of their submission, and I happen to personally think there were a lot of virtues of the submission, but she, in a gratuitous aside, she goes attacking those who had gone before, claiming that they were arguing for space beams and no planes and all that, which was no part of any of our submission. She even was so blatant as to suggest that I was one of those submitting a request, for which I cannot take credit. I would have been proud to have done so, but those who did deserve all the credit for it. It was brilliant work. She was even implying that they were, you know, discrediting the 9/11 movement when their work is very thorough and painstaking and preceded the submission by this group from Truth and Justice. I found it a repulsive performance. And now today on Blogger, we find Victoria Ashley is repeating in this inimical style of hers, where she's attacking persons who are being featured on these Patriots Question 9/11 websites. And she's saying that, you know, the new additions look good until you look closely. And she talks about David Shaler, who she says believes that missiles surrounded by holograms may have destroyed the Twin Towers. Morgan Reynolds, who argues that no big Boeings crashed into the World Trade Center. Judy Wood, Star Wars space beam weapon destroyed the World Trade Center. James Fetzer claims that these people are the scholars of 9/11 in many different fora. And she goes on to say, why would Alan Miller want hologram and space beam advocates to speak up for us and stand alongside the rest of the sincere and sane people who question the official story? Now, let me point out, Victoria Ashley, to the best of my knowledge, is an English lit major. She would have no qualification for judging any of the scientific issues involved here. For her to claim she's speaking for the research community is ridiculous. There are many divisions within the research community. There are many divisions within 9/11. And to imply that one group is insane because they don't agree with your view is a completely offensive position to take, but it's typical of her style. I was fascinated when I was in Brooklyn recently and participated in a debate with Ron Wyk and Mark Roberts on his show Hardfire, to discover that both of them are also English lit majors. Neither of them has a background in science. And it's very interesting to me how persons who seem to be most keen about defending, say, the official view, and an awful lot of the views that are defended on the Truth and Justice website are really very sympathetic to the government's official view. Jim Hoffman, for example, having been an outspoken proponent of the thesis that a Boeing 757 actually did hit the Pentagon, in spite of all of the evidence to the contrary. And anyone who wants to assess this for themselves, I'd invite them to go to 911scholars.org and review one of our more recent press conferences concerning new studies by pilots for 9/11 truth, which substantiates four other lines of argument that, in my opinion, establish conclusively that no Boeing 757 hit the building. But here is Victoria Ashley going on to say, if some of the leaders of the peace movement were saying in public the bombs that fell in Iraq were just pretend, they were actually holograms, would you be encouraged to join the organization? Well, this is just nasty stuff. It's very unjust. She's not looking at the evidence. Morgan has excellent arguments to give, and whether you agree or disagree with his conclusion, there's no question but what he is serious in his research. Judy Wood, when she uses the phrase Star Wars beam weapon, is talking about directed energy weapons that emerged out of research that's colloquially referred to as the Star Wars program launched in the year of Ronald Reagan. So it doesn't mean that these are necessarily space located. They could be ground-based. They could be air-based, they could be mounted in aircraft, they could be on dirigibles, they could be used from satellites. Hey, even Bob Bowman, who was the director of the Star Wars Research Program in several administrations, who has a PhD in nuclear engineering from Caltech, conceded recently that the whole program was intended to be offensive. Well, not defensive. Well, it can't be offensive if they don't have space-based weapons. And in fact, Judy has been doing a lot of research here and discovered, you know, a huge amount of evidence substantiating the existence of a vast variety of families of these weapons. So it's ridiculous to dismiss the possibility, which is all she's ever advanced, as you well know, Russ, on the grounds that this is supposed to be insane. And I just say this is another disgusting example of what's going on by these people from Truth and Justice, for whom I have no sympathy whatsoever. None.
It follows the science by press conference and science by poll analysis that Malov does on page 144 of his book. In one particular instance, and I think it was at the Baltimore Conference of the American Physical Society in May 1st through 3rd of 1989, Jones asked a group sitting at the head table in front of the entire American Physical Society gathering that was there, he asked them, he took an impromptu straw poll, and he asked nine of the session's leading speakers, you know, do they believe that there was excess heat? And it's like, you can't run science by poll. You run it by observing the various sets of data that were presented by the scientists.
Oh, you're absolutely right, Russ. It's just the way this 9/11 blogger is run. It's like it's a popularity thing, and social cohesion is the criterion, not logic and evidence. I cannot tell you how many times when I've made a post there before they booted me out for being divisive because I was presenting a point of view different than that which those who manage that site wanted to have the conformist line. By there, we'll return to these issues right after this. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, with my special guest, Russ Gerst. Thursday today, my special guest, Russ Gerst, and I are discussing parallels between research in cold fusion and the 9/11 truth movement. And Russ, before we return to your insights based on your study of Mallow's book, I'd just like to mention one further point, just as this Victoria Ashley can't get things straight by observing, by claiming in a press release from Truth and Justice that I have submitted a request for correction. She says here that I claim that the above people, including David Shaler, who's supposed to be the hologram advocate, are leaders in the movement. Well, I never talk about David Shaler. I think David Shaler may be a very fine person. I certainly have no reason to question his integrity or sincerity, and I would need to know the context and all this other thing. People will have lots of views at lots of different times based on different amounts of evidence, and it's very easy to take things out of context. And here you find this spokesperson for Truth and Justice doing just that, taking phrases or expression out of context without explaining them, running things together, getting it garbled to create a particular impression. This is very, very inaccurate. It's creating a false impression. It's got nothing to do with the truth, and certainly is abandoning any principles of justice. So I find this infuriating, Russ, and it's going on so much from that particular group that it's, to me, completely disgusting.
Well, it's very consistent, too. I mean, perception is 90% of what people get from things, and if the perception is that certain people are a little bit crazy, or, you know, that their ideas are put out there as being a little bit, you know, different, that gives us enough reason to discredit them and kind of throw them out with the bathwater, rather than actually looking at the work they are doing. And I guess that's kind of what leads into, you know, what the perception is of Dr. Jones, both in the 9/11 arena as well as in the cold fusion arena. I think if everybody kind of remembers back, you know, Dr. Jones kind of blew onto the scene when he had his interview on MSNBC and came off as, you know, the innocent, doting physicist who is questioning the fall times of the buildings and such.
We're talking about the Tucker Carlson interview?
The Tucker Carlson interview. And that was really when a lot of folks, you know, kind of jumped on the scientific bandwagon. You know, science is as pure as the wind-driven snow, and there would be no politics related to that. He's just going to tell it straight up. And it's interesting that in Mallow's book, he cited the same information, and this, again, is on page 49. He talks about Dr. Jones. He says, you know, he's a member of the Church of Latter-day Saints. He's a father of seven children. His frameless glasses give him an upstanding, almost Boy Scoutish bearing. He speaks in a soft voice with a hesitation at times, grinning and laughing frequently. He pursues his science with religious fervor, almost literally. I mean, the tie-ins are so direct and so exact comparing the two groupings. And he came on the scene, he had a reputation of having done muon-catalyzed fusion. So the physics community already gave him the benefit of the doubt whenever he would say, you know, they're not seeing what they say they're seeing. And then he could go in and then start, you know, telling everybody what they should know. And he cites and references in various points in his book, and it's so extremely consistent. It's almost hard to believe that anybody, if they were actually doing that, would use the same exact tack, but we're seeing it.
Yeah, that's really quite fascinating, Russ. I do want you to draw out the parallels here, and you found corroborating accounts in other books, I understand.
Yeah, one other book that I read, and this was just more based on my interest in the cold fusion, simply because the more the science is allowed to work on the problem, the more they're proving that cold fusion, really low energy nuclear reactions are for real. And one of the books was by a Tadahiko Mizuno, a researcher out of Japan. And on page 75 of his book, he cites the ICC4 conference that they had on cold fusion. And in that, he cites Dr. Jones' presentation. In particular, made one wonder whether he was serious about doing research. He presented slides that looked like they were part of a tour guide, and he retracted his previous claims of a weak neutron flux from cold fusion. He turned completely about-face, claiming instead that the neutrons must have originated from radioactive contaminations in the sample. Many researchers had concluded that neutron claims were extremely weak and doubtful at best. So perhaps he decided to go with the flow. It is not clear whether he had some ulterior motive, but in any case, his presentation had a weird feel to it. So, I mean, it's just, you know.
And you're reading from the book when you say those things.
That's exactly from the book verbatim.
So this is another scientist who's actually an expert in the field who's commenting on Jones's performance at that time.
Right. He spells it out. He says, you know, we were sitting there all anticipating his assessment of the science, and all we got was a slideshow that looked like, you know, it was a tour guide. And in the end, they really wondered about his motivations for doing what he did.
Well, bear in mind that every year that the cold fusion is held in abeyance or kept off of the market or unavailable for use is a year during which the gas and oil companies make hundreds of billions of additional dollars. I mean, you know, this is a, if it is the case that cold fusion is viable, then it's in the enormous financial interest of these mega companies to keep it unavailable as long as possible.
Exactly. And that is what it appears to be with cold fusion. I mean, later in Malow's book, you know, they asked Dr. Jones at a conference, you know, when do you expect cold fusion to actually bear fruit? And he said, well, 20 years to never. And that came on the heels of about 4 years previously, and this was prior to the Pons and Fleischmann announcement. In his own report, they indicated that they felt that there would be positive energy gain from cold fusion type reactions in the near future. So, I mean, it totally disputed what he had said 3 and 4 years prior.
I don't see how the man can turn into a prophet. I mean, the history of science, like the history of technology, is virtually impossible to predict. You'd have to know about all the innovations that are going to be made before they've even been conceived by the mind of man. So how anyone could, you know, consider themselves to be a responsible scientist and offer a sweeping, you know, negative judgment like that is beyond me.
Well, and in particular when, you know, the biggest emphasis should have been on the excess heat that was being produced by their experiments on cold fusion. That was the real issue. It's like it was unexplainable in levels that were far in excess of anything that any chemical process could have put forward.
Okay. This vote thing is fascinating to me because it's as though he would turn to an audience and say, how many of you believe space teams took down the towers, see? And here you get social pressure and everything else, you know. Who under those conditions is going to allow the possibility space beams, whatever they may be, could have taken down the towers? I mean, this is the level at which he is operating, by and large, it appears to me, in relation to these very serious questions that Judy has raised based upon hard evidence. I mean, here's a guy who talks about hard evidence. He never tires of describing himself as a scientist. He has as his email address hard evidence, but he doesn't trade in it. He's not being serious about it. When he and William Deagle had this exchange in Vancouver, and they both congratulated one another on being, you know, empirically oriented and basing their views on science, they both immediately concluded, you know, Steve said, well, I'm sure we can dismiss the idea that space beams were involved, and Deagle immediately agreed, but that's independent of any evidence. We're not looking at the evidence or the arguments. That's just being arbitrarily dismissive.
Yep, that's exactly the modus.
It sounds like a modus operandi. We'll be right back with my... This is Jim Fester, your host, on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett. Well, you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. My special guest today is Russ Gerst, and we're talking about the development of the 9/11 truth community in relation to research, and especially the role of Stephen Jones. Russ, I'm interested in whether you would agree with three tendencies I have seen present here. One is... the swooning before authority. I mean, Stephen Jones presents himself as an authority, and you know, people, for example, a 9/11 blogger who wouldn't know a neutron from a proton swoon at his feet as though he is the, you know, all-seeing eye, the speaker of truth, when in fact he's not actually an expert in the areas that are most relevant. So here you have him doing the stuff on muon catalytic fusion and so forth, this cold fusion related thing, and which is, you know, no obvious connection to the destruction of the World Trade Center. And here you have a scientist who has degrees in civil engineering with a specialty in structural engineering and engineering mechanics, which is applied physics. Steve Jones doesn't even have that. And in materials engineering science, which are three disciplines exactly relevant to what happened at the World Trade Center. She has 60 articles as an assistant professor. He has 40 for his career as a full professor. I mean, the question of which of these persons is more authoritative, has a higher degree of expertise in relation to the relevant areas, it's a no-brainer. This is ridiculous.
It is consistent, Jim, because related to the cold fusion, what he would do there is dismiss the calorimetry measurements that were being made by these chemists, electrochemists, and that is their specialty. They have a very profound background in calorimetry, and he was dismissing it. He was a physicist. Physicists don't have that background. So how can he come out and say that, you know, the excess heat that was measured could just be dismissed as being an error? I mean, and that's very similar to what we're seeing here, where he's claiming his expertise relative to an area that Judy Wood just completely outweighs him.
It's just stunning to me, you know, the utter inconsistency. Okay, if you want to appeal to authorities, at least don't make them fallacious appeals. And when you have somebody whose qualifications are so overwhelmingly greater than the next guy, if they have a difference, you should at least be willing to take seriously the possibility that the person with a greater degree of competence and qualification just might be right.
Right.
Here's another tendency, Russ, and then you come back to this if you like. This appeal to Occam's razor, you know, the idea that the simplest explanation is preferable. Well, that has an important caveat or qualification. This is the simplest explanation that can account for all of the data. And what we find here is Stephen Jones systematically ignoring the relevant data to which Judy Wood and Morgan Reynolds have been drawing so much attention. I mean, you know, if Steve were a sincere scientist, he'd be pouring over Judy Wood and Morgan Reynolds' work on this website and looking at all of the photographs they have presented and understanding why some of the evidence they've adduced means that some of what he has been relying upon in the form of photographs, like all these guys peering down into this cavern, or this grappler hauling off this piece of molten metal, or what he has presumed to be smoke that's supposed to be from vast pools, why none of that appears to be justifiable, why most of the arguments or evidence that he would cite in support of his claims about thermite and thermate really don't have an empirical foundation, and where that stream of molten whatever coming out of the 80th floor looks as though it's more readily explainable on the basis of a massive array of batteries that the Fuji Bank had present, where lead has a much lower melting point than steel, and where that's a far more plausible explanation. If you want to talk about Occam, that should be lead pouring out of the 80th floor makes a whole lot more sense, especially when you claim that there's thermite all over the buildings, and yet you're only getting this effect at this one location.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very consistent that way. Very consistent.
Extremely selective use of evidence, in other words, and fallacious appeal to authority, and misuse of a scientific principle, namely Occam's razor.
Right. And then to go and turn it around on the other observers as using pathological science where you're just making things up. And that seems extremely inconsistent for someone who says that he's all about the science and evaluating the data. And that has been emphasized over the course of the time that he's been involved, is we have to look at the data and then we have to assess it. And what we've seen a lot of is we came up with the answer immediately and now we're defending it and pushing every other answer away.
Right. And science progresses, you know, on the basis of new evidence and new hypotheses.
Right.
And the fact that some of these possibilities weren't even contemplated in the beginning doesn't mean that they aren't serious or may not provide a more adequate explanation than anything that's gone before.
Right.
He's even been dismissive of the idea that many nukes of one kind or another could have been employed on the basis of low tritium level readings, and yet I am hearing from other sources that the tritium has a very short half-life, and that the delays in taking these measurements were considerable, about a month, so that you'd get lower readings even if there'd been massive tritium. And other sources suggest that the tritium levels were as much as 55 times higher than he has been willing to allow.
Yeah, and again, that is very consistent with what was happening in this other research, where what they did was they said, you know, all of the evidence of what's going on from a nuclear perspective with cold fusion should be immediately identifiable within months. And as it's come to be learned, these were very tedious experiments that had to be taken on, as is assembling all of the data, all the pictures, all the evidence related to 9/11. And, I mean, we've seen, since Morgan and Judy have started their work, stepping back and looking from zero, it's taken, you know, almost a year to get to the point where they are right now. And look at all the data they've had to assemble and then try to assess what was consistent among all of it.
So, and that's so right, Russ. I mean, I've been in awe. I mean, there have been at least four major aspects to this. One is the extent of the pulverization and the massive source of energy necessary to pulverize so much of both of those buildings, number one. Number two is the role of the bathtub. I hadn't even pondered the role of the bathtub and how you had to have the pulverization so you wouldn't destroy the bathtub and flood the subways and the path train tunnels and underground Manhattan with Hudson River water. And then third, we get the toasted car phenomenon, which appears increasingly to be related to this toxic cloud of dust that is emerging and covering lower Manhattan. And then fourth, of course, we have the role of the dirt. I mean, Judy is getting really good at dishing the dirt. It's fascinating to find that you have this vast quantity of dirt being brought in.
Right. And again, what I have been doing what I've been looking at is just looking at various similarities, and it's just amazing how similar the behavior is. It's not so much that, you know, I have a vendetta against Dr. Jones. All I'm wanting to do is look at the data before and after each different case and make comparisons.
So I must say, as a certified public accountant, I'm sure you don't make decisions about how numbers add and subtract based upon whether you're particularly fond of the person you're working for.
And the science isn't proven out by, you know, a lot of false or negative results. If you have a positive result, you have to be able to explain it.
We're trading here on logic and evidence, not personality and popularity.
Right.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Russ Gerst. He's a certified public accountant, a background in mathematics, and someone who's keenly interested and has been following the recent history of 9/11 research, especially the role of Steve Jones. Russ, just to make a really general observation, when this division took place in November of 2006, there was an obvious difference in attitude. I was being inclusive. I was wanting to open up the scope of research to consider alternative possibilities, such as mini-nukes, hydrogen, or atomic, or third or fourth generation, or exotic weapons, lasers, masers, plasmoids, antimatter, all that sort of thing. But I wasn't tossing out thermite, thermate. I was explaining I don't think it has the potential to explain all the data, and therefore we're of necessity forced to consider alternatives, even if we might prefer not to consider them for psychological reasons. From a scientific point of view, however, I mean, nothing could be more appropriate than broadening the scope of the research project. Now, those who broke away and tried to destroy the website and all that sort of thing in very unscrupulous ways were being extremely exclusive. They were wanting to exclude consideration of any other alternative than the one that they had settled upon, most of them having no competence whatsoever to judge whether it was scientifically acceptable or not. I offer Alex Flom as a perfect example. Here's a guy who's an intellectual property attorney and would have no competence to judge this issue, and yet he would, you know, be adamant in going with Stephen Jones and in controlling the access to the website I'd spent a year developing out of nothing. I mean, to me, it's just stunning. And then you have all of these people, these bloggers on 9/11 Blogger, who seem to me to have the role of wanting to contain research that if it gets outside of that narrow channel, then they all ferociously attack. I mean, very viciously, almost always ad hominems. I mean, you hardly ever have any discussion of evidence or reasoning based on evidence on 9/11 Blogger. To me, it's just astonishing, which leads me to infer that 9/11 Blogger is a mechanism for controlling research on 9/11, and that these two groups appear to me to be intimately intertwined. In fact, it turns out that Alex Flom, who also authors a blog under the name of George Washington, is one of those who runs that site, and I understand he's even told people that I am a disinformation operator, which I find quite amusing, but also outrageous. I mean, this is just part and parcel of what's going on here, I think, in terms of attempting to control, manage, maintain, restrain the serious research on 9/11.
Yes, and when you get to the specific science of things, one of the issues noted by Malov was the peer review process and how it was also used to control who was getting published and who was not. And that has been a big sticking point in the 9/11 truth movement, particularly with Dr. Jones when he came out with the journal that you had with the scholars group, and then he moved over with his Scholars for 9/11 Justice group. It was all based on you have to have peer review. And unfortunately, they were controlling who the peer reviewers were, and if you weren't part of that group that was the acceptable science, you know, in quotation marks, your peer review basically shut you down.
Well, it was ridiculous. I mean, I told Steve way back when that the key to having a significant journal is having a first-class editorial board. I had myself founded a journal, Minds and Machines, and put together what many others told me they thought was the best editorial board they'd ever seen. Before that, I'd co-edited for 10 years a major philosophy journal by the name of Synthes. I've been on many editorial boards. So when I was initially supposed to serve as the managing editor, I told Steve, you know, the key was putting together a really high-quality board. He never did that. And, you know, when he would put someone like Alex Flom on the editorial board of what's supposed to be a scientific journal, I thought it was an absurdity.
Right.
And the way they have used that whole business of peer review, peer review, if it isn't by competent, independent authorities, is meaningless. And what he does is have a bunch of his friends and buddies rubber stamp his stuff and write trash attacks on others. That journal is well described as a junk journal. Anyone who has a serious understanding of scholarship has to appreciate that it's a junk journal in a very technical sense. Indeed, you know, Steve Jones' own latest paper, which I'm going to discuss tomorrow on the program, in my opinion, isn't even a publishable paper. And I can go through the paper and explain to you exactly why. It's not a publishable paper, but it sailed through the peer review status. In fact, this guy changes his paper so often, you wonder every time he makes a change, is that supposed to qualify as another peer review?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, the peer review process that was being seen back in 89 and 90 and then actually to this day related to Cold Fusion, the editors of major scientific journals would not even accept the peer reviews that they might have, not to mention doing their own peer reviews and editorial reviews. And it was so subjective rather than being objective that the science was tossed out. I mean,
we're talking about Cold Fusion again now.
Cold Fusion again. And
that,
again,
the peer review process was manipulated in order to control research on Cold Fusion.
Absolutely.
And of course, the shell game was played. I mean, one of the most astonishing events in 9/11 is the trial of Zacharias Moussaoui, who in April of 2005 was found guilty of participating in a plot to hit the White House with a plane to free this blind sheik who'd been involved in the 1993 attack on the Twin Towers, where he denied he had anything to do with the attack on the 9/11. And yet in April of 2006, he was being tried to be punishment for his involvement in 9/11. I mean, here you have federal prosecutors who were playing a shell game with the American people. Now, it seems to me we have similar things going on here in cold fusion, because you got Steve Jones doing research on a very different type of cold fusion than Pons and Fleshman, and yet it's being used to discredit Pons and Fleshman's work.
Right, and it was obviously very deceptive, because it was very well known that what his research had done was not creating excess heat. And excess heat was the phenomena that everybody was looking for. Well, if you're not creating the phenomena that is being examined, how can you then do research into all the other characteristics and then come out and say that it's obvious that it's you know, just a big myth?
Excellent question, Russ. We'll be right back with my special guest, Russ Gerst. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Russ Gerst is and I are discussing the recent history of the 9/11 research movement. Russ, let me ask you this question. Do you think Steve Jones didn't know the difference between his research and that of Pons and Fleshman?
There's no way he couldn't have known. I mean, he had been involved with Pons and Fleshman prior to their announcement, and they had actually shared their information because they were going to submit papers together to the journal Nature. And they had agreed upon a time, and I think it was actually the day after Pons and Fleshman made their announcement, they were going to submit articles of their own together, and they were actually going to put them in a single envelope and mail them together. So they were very knowledgeable about what the others were doing. And I guess the other thing that's interesting related to this is, Stephen Jones was asked to review the Pons and Fleshman request of the Department of Energy back in 1988, and it was considered somewhat unethical what he was doing, because typically somebody who's actually receiving money in the field that is being requested for,
kind of the conflict of interest.
Out.
It's
yeah.
A conflict of interest.
Absolutely, and he went ahead and did it anyway, and so he had all the information.
Unethical.
Absolutely. And he had all the information of what they were doing, how they were conducting their
experiments. I thought this man was a religious man. Is he somehow finding there's no connection between his religious beliefs and his ethical practice or lack thereof? That's rather stunning to me.
It makes you wonder how hypocritical a person could be if they are acting in that way.
And do I understand there are a variety of weird events related to all the Malov research, including that someone who was associated with it was murdered, or was it he himself?
Well, Eugene Malov was murdered in 2004. And the details surrounding it, you know, pertain to a couple of thugs that, you know, were trying to rob him or something like that while he was cleaning an old rental property that used to be his parents' and his childhood home.
A couple of thugs were trying to rob him?
Yes.
That's exactly parallel to what happened to Michael Ziemer in 2006.
And you have to make that connection. It's like, you know, even though the details are obscured to us, it's like, how coincidental is it that it's the exact same situation?
Was Malov continuing his research into this area?
Probably was. He was actually publishing his own newsletter, or actually a magazine at that point, that centered on cold fusion and presenting the actual research. I mean, the papers that were being written in the area, you know, weren't being accepted anywhere. I mean, they were in what was considered, and this is in the Charles Baudet book, Excess Heat. He called it, you know, the proverbial scientific ghetto. They were basically outcasts, similar to those that are in the 9/11 truth movement, and were not being allowed to be published. They weren't allowed to be in the major journals. So he provided a journal that allowed them to present their information and get their papers
Well, you can well imagine that if Malov represents, you know, a cold fusion energy alternative that could render oil virtually worthless, that this is there's going to be a powerful incentive for him not to have his research terminated.
Well, exactly. When you have billions of dollars at stake, and that's what we're seeing in quarterly profits every quarter by all these major companies, they have a lot at stake to keep this under wraps and not allow it out any sooner than it inevitably will be. I mean, the science will eventually win the day, but, you know, if you can add on profits for another 20 years while you're figuring out how to get control of it and actually make money from it, that's what you have to do.
And, of course, Michael Ziemer was doing research with Judy Wood on aluminum, on molten aluminum, and, you know, it was a fertile source of empirical research here to support the inference that when you're looking at that streaming fluid coming out of the 80th floor, that it could have been molten aluminum as much as it could have been molten steel, but I'm personally convinced that it was neither. Almost certainly it had to be molten lead for the reasons I've already articulated. Now, I'd hate to think that Michael Ziemer was being murdered as Malov appears to have been because of his research, but it's not, it can't be ruled out.
Well, when you have the fear of all the money that you're making in the military-industrial complex, as well as the fact that, you know, anybody that is ever eventually brought to account for this massive crime and deception of the world, I mean, there's a lot riding on it. And, you know, for folks to be starting to get close or appear to get close makes you wonder if there is a parallel there.
Now, is it also the case that your research has led you to investigate connections or links between Stephen Jones, the Department of Energy, Los Alamos? I mean, I get the impression that an awful lot of those,
this guy,
Greg Jenkins, who seems to come out of nowhere, somehow have ties to the Department of Energy in Los Alamos, too. Is there a group connection here?
Well, on page 109 of his book, it talks about the research that Jones was doing back in the early 80s. He and his Comet colleagues in 1982 undertook a major experimental effort. And they were doing it at the Los Alamos Mason Physics Facility. And they were under the sponsorship of the Department of Energy's Richard Gashevsky. So right there, in about two lines in his book, he ties them all the way through. And it's very consistent that they are involved with Los Alamos and the Department of Energy, which means you also have the oil companies and the government involved. So,
and potentially high-tech weapons of the kind that might have been used on 9/11. I mean,
absolutely.
It seems to me this is a very nasty combination.
And another person that was spelled out in the book, his last name was Hagelstein. He was involved in the X-ray laser related to SDI. And he came from, I think it's another one of the research centers. I can't remember right offhand which one it is. I can find it after the break. But he moved back to MIT just so that he could study the cold fusion phenomenon. And it said right in there that he was involved in development of the X-ray laser as part of SDI, and he had serious scruples about the ethics of it all, because he thought it was going to be used for something other than maybe defensive purposes. So obviously the connections between the two, you can definitely make the leap. Now, being able to go back and research more and actually tie those things together is what needs to happen. But I'm sure a lot of the things that Judy has been finding in her work, connecting the various government laboratories, is very similar to what Malov was talking about, even though he was focusing more on the cold fusion side of things.
This is very interesting. I'm learning about Malov that he had a BS and an MS in aeronautics and astronomy from MIT and a PhD in environmental health sciences from Harvard University. He'd worked for technology engineering firms such as Hughes Research Laboratories, the Analytic Science Corporation, and MIT's Lincoln Laboratory, and was a consultant in research and development of new energies. This sounds like a very interesting guy, especially one who's willing to look into research on the edge, you know, the so-called fringe science topics that most or many conservative mainline scientists aren't willing to consider.
And he had a very high moral ethical standing, too. He did leave his position after some of the deceptions that were going on at MIT.
I'll be right back with my special guest, Russ Gerst. And he's been making an appraisal of the recent history of the 9/11 truth movement, and especially he has been exploiting insights he's derived from studying work on the history of cold fusion, especially a book by Eugene Mallove entitled Fire from Ice, Searching for the Truth Behind the Cold Fusion Furor, published in 1991, which deals extensively with Stephen Jones' role there. And Russ, if I were to ask you to sort of summarize the parallels as you see them for the benefit of our audience, what would you suggest are the most important insights that you've derived from reading Mallove's book?
Well, I think it's just following the whole inception of, you know, an entrance into both programs. I mean, here's this supposed expert who's the innocent Boy Scout looking person who then comes in, takes over both groups as far as being the outspoken expert. He then starts pushing his own ideas as to what is truth and what is not. And anybody that is not inclusive in his way of thinking is tagged, named, they're called true believers or space beamers or, you know, no planers, that sort of thing. And it just continues to evolve, and ad hominem attacks are very consistent in both sides.
Creating a journal to give an aura of respectability, but stacking it with his buddies so that peer review becomes meaningless, and then using a gang of intellectual thugs like Greg Jenkins and Jim Hoffman and Victoria Ashley and even, alas, Alex Flom to serve as the vanguard and savage any who would disagree, and then Blogger coming in to reinforce. It's really quite an appalling picture.
Yep. And the other thing that we're seeing now is a lot of the stage photo opportunities, like the recent videotape with he and the other so-called expert. I think it's Mr. Deagle. He had kind of a similar staged event from appearances' sake with one of the other physicists back in the cold fusion days in the early stages, where he was forced to somewhat defend the fact that he was finding minor neutron nump counts in his research. And, of course, he got angry, but he held back because he was a good Christian and such. And that's what we were seeing in some of that, where he somewhat disagreed with Mr. Deagle. He looked like he got a little upset, and then he was able to bite his lip and then move forward and badmouth the bad guys, as it was. And we saw that in both.
And these events are rigged in the sense that the serious critics who have different views, like Judy Wood or Morgan Reynolds, simply aren't even invited. I mean,
right.
even out in Chandler, you know, it was only very reluctantly that he was nudged into having an exchange with me, which was an isolated aspect of the entire convention because it only lasted, I don't know, one hour out of the entire conference was devoted to serious science. And here he recycled his presentation, the one we've all seen so many times. It has really more political than scientific content.
Yeah, and I guess in a general way of looking at things, I think anybody that's even considering, you know, looking at 9/11 truth, they should consider reading Mallove's book first, because then they would get an understanding of what Dr. Jones meant to that whole issue. And then when they start researching 9/11 truth, they can see the consistency with how he's behaving. And also understand that he was on the wrong side of science there, so what makes anybody believe that he's going to be on the correct side of science here?
Fascinating. Fascinating. And, of course, if you gain these insights from reading Mallove's book, what do you think Malov would have had to say were he still alive today about
exactly.
Stephen Jones' involvement in 9/11?
And I think, you know, there are other researchers out there that would have a lot to say on this. I mean, particularly like at Texas A&M, because a Dr. John Bockris that was there was tremendously bad-mouthed, destroyed. His career was almost ruined. He almost lost his tenure. And, you know, he basically said, my career is over anyway. I'm going to go on the side of science and do right by it. So he would be a gentleman that I would think would be a wonderful person to talk to about the behavior of the physics community in general, and specifically related to how Stephen Jones behaved.
I thought it very odd that, you know, there's been so much sympathy extended to Stephen Jones when he was basically, I think, taken out of the classroom and given a research assignment, whereas Judy, for example, whose work is, putting it conservatively, at least as important, obviously I consider it to be overwhelmingly more so, actually was denied a tenured position in all probability precisely because of her dedication to truth about 9/11. I mean, look, how many assistant professors have 60 papers?
Yeah. And the other thing, too, is, you know, there are so many consistencies where something happens to, you know, someone on this side, or somebody does something like submitting papers for requests for correction. Well, Judy did it, so they have to come around and say, yeah, we were planning it all the time. And you just see that where they're jumping in right after the fact so that they can look like they're doing as much, but really they're just trying to be copycats and look like they're doing as much as, you know, the true researchers.
Russ, I think you're right. There's real science and there's pseudoscience, and I'm afraid from one side that has the gall to call itself truth and justice, we're getting very little of either.
Right, right.
I can't thank you enough for coming on. I really would like for you to just spend a few more minutes, you know, telling if you had the opportunity to meet with a group like on Blogger, for example, and tell them what you've discovered, what would you suggest that they should do if they want to really understand what's going on in the 9/11 research movement?
Well, when you talk about like places like 9/11 Blogger, it just appears that 90% of the folks there are out there to trash anything that has to do with alternative views. And I have serious concerns that the folks that are there wouldn't listen in the first place because they already have a preset motive of what they're doing. And for the real innocent researcher or the person that wants to get at the truth, I mean, they need to go out and actually read for themselves. They need to look at the various websites and make up their own decision, because when someone tells you how to think, what to look at and what not to look at, you have to act like a teenager at that point and say, well, if they're telling me what to do, I'm going to do just the opposite. And what that is look at everything, make up your own mind.
I haven't seen evidence of a lot of independent thinkers there. They all seem to be in the grip of a group mind, collective thinking, where they are very severe in enforcing their own standards in relation to one another. I find it intellectually embarrassing because it's at such a low level of development or mental engagement with the real issues. I mean, if you care about truth about 9/11, you're going to have to sharpen your wits and be able to sort some things out, which in some cases aren't that tough.
And you have to be willing to make up your own mind and not get drawn into the politics of the issue, because even if you believe science is pure, it still has politics. There's still a lot of money in it, and people are going to do things based on their own, you know, financial advantage.
Russ, I can't thank you enough for coming on the Dynamic Duo. You've provided us with a great deal to think about. I want to express my appreciation to everyone who's out there. Give this a lot of thought. These are serious issues. It's Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo.